This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, an update on the most pressing issues facing the African continent. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. An apparent coup d'etat in Niger has alarmed the region and elicited condemnation from the African Union, the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, and the West. Niger has been a key U.S. ally in helping fight a violent insurgency in the region. It is home to drone bases used in counterterrorism operations. On Thursday last week, Niger's Army Command declared its support for the coup carried out by soldiers of the Presidential Guard. The United States joined African leaders in calling for the release of Niger President Mohamed Bazoum, who was being held inside the country's presidential palace. A summit between Russian President Vladimir Putin and African leaders in St. Petersburg kicked off Thursday of last week with a far lower turnout than in previous years. Kenyan President William Ruto did not attend, saying that Russia's decision to withdraw from the Black Sea grain deal was a, quote, stab in the back of global food security prices, close quote. We will also discuss the status of and prospects for ending the civil war in Sudan. Last but not least, we will examine the U.S.-Africa relationship given the Biden administration's interest in deepening mutually beneficial ties with the continent. So for more on developments in Africa, we are joined by two top African observers. Ambassador Michelle Gavin is former ambassador to Botswana, currently director of Africa at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Susan Stigant. She's director of Africa programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace based in Washington. And both women join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carol.
Ambassador Gavin, Michelle Gavin, let me begin with you, and let's start with the coup in Niger. The president was seized. Soldiers went on television to announce that the constitution had been dissolved and all public institutions suspended. This is certainly a very sad and ominous development for a democracy. What is your reaction to this development, and to what extent does it present a major setback to a democratically elected government?
Well, I agree with you. It's incredibly sad, incredibly alarming, sadly, not terribly surprising. Niger has been fragile for some time. There have been coup attempts recently, and it is part of a region that is struggling with so much state fragility, so much insecurity, that there is a great deal of instability and popular demand for change. So let me be clear. I'm not suggesting that there is popular demand for this coup, right? And reports from on the ground suggest there have been demonstrations both for restoring the constitution and demonstrations in favor of the military seizure of power. But I do think as this kind of fluid situation unfolds, one thing that it's important to focus on is that status quo conditions in places like Niger are unsustainable for the population. The degree of insecurity, the extreme poverty, and the sense that external partners are not helping to affect the kind of changes people want to see. And so if there's anything I think we can take away right now and seize on, it's that those of us who wish to see more democratic governance push back on authoritarianism really need to think long and hard about what popular demands are being expressed and the degree to which we are being responsive to those demands.
Turning to you, Susan Stigant, for your reaction to developments and what Michelle Gavin said. It's an important base for sure, a drone base for counterterrorism activities, a very important ally to the United States. But as Michelle said, if fragility and insecurity continues, people's needs are not met, these types of events will keep happening, and we need to know how to respond.
Carol, I think it really highlights this distressing trend across the region. There have been more than 10 attempted or successful, which is probably the wrong term, coups that have taken place in the very, very recent past. And I think that figuring out how to respond is something that the U.S. government, that the region, that the African Union, that political leadership in this region are really trying to figure out. We know that African citizens, over time, they're always expressing their preference for accountable governance, for more democratic and responsive government leadership. At the same time, more recently, there's been an indication in some of the research done by Afrobarometer, public opinion research across the continent, that has indicated that more people are open to the idea of military leadership for a particular time to deal with a particular issue. I think, as Michelle indicated, this doesn't mean that people are necessarily in favor of military-led governments for a long time period. It doesn't necessarily mean they're in favor of a coup, and they're certainly not in favor of some of the behavior that we see with some military-led regimes, where they are working and intertwining economic interests, where they are not necessarily responding to the same security concerns any better than the elected governments may have been. But I think civilian populations are really struggling with what to do. I'll say one bright spot in terms of a lot of unknowns at the moment of what's happening in Niger has been the response by the new president of Nigeria, President Tinubu, and the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, that they have mobilized immediately, that they have indicated their strong support for the democratic governance in the country. They haven't just said that from faraway capitals. They've sent a delegation that is there and that is talking with the people who are holding power and making decisions right now. And we know that that kind of regional leadership is absolutely critical. And I think what we'll be watching is, how does the United States express its support and offer concrete support to that type of initiative from ECOWAS and from other leaders across the African continent?
Thank you for that contribution, Susan, especially regarding Nigerian President Tinubu and the role of ECOWAS. That's very critical. Back to you, Michelle Gavin. Very quickly, do we know to what extent maybe Russia is perhaps exploiting this, or to what extent maybe they were involved in any way, do you think, in this coup attempt?
I certainly don't know, and I don't want to mislead any listener to suggest that I do. I do know that President Bazoum had expressed concerns back in March about Russian disinformation, misinformation campaigns aimed at undermining support for his government, suggesting that he's some sort of puppet of particularly French interests. And there is widespread anti-French sentiment throughout the region. Again, I think reflective of a rejection of the status quo, in a sense that external powers who have been heavily engaged for a long time have not helped to drive toward outcomes that people want. So do these kinds of developments create opportunities for Russia? Absolutely, they do. These military juntas, as Susan rightly pointed out, they're not accountable. They're going to be pursuing their own self-interest. And we have seen them make common cause with Russia and Russian-backed entities, particularly the Wagner Group, to secure their place in the seat of power as security for the population actually gets significantly worse.
And very quickly to you, Susan Stigant, and I certainly wouldn't want to assert that there is a so-called Russian hand behind this, but just like Michelle said, they can certainly exploit this to their advantage, the Wagner Group, for their malign activities. What would you add or subtract to what Michelle said, and how dangerous this is for Russia and the Wagner Group when you have these types of coups, anti-democratic actions?
I agree with Michelle that Russia doesn't have to create these types of polarizations. They don't have to create the stories or the narratives around external influence and the problems of external influence. Those exist, and those exist for very, very good historic and contemporary reasons. And so I think the challenge that it puts before the United States and other partners is to move as quickly and decisively as possible to understand what has actually driven this coup. What are the grievances that need to be addressed? What are the partnerships that need to be delivered? Secretary Blinken was in Niger earlier this year, committed $150 million of assistance. But either that's not moving at the right speed, it's not getting to the right people, it's not addressing the immediate concerns in a way that actually allows the space and oxygen for governments to make the very difficult decisions and to manage the very fair expectations that citizens have. So I think the risk is real, but the risk isn't underlined by Russia itself. This exists already, and I think it's the challenges to all of us to figure out how to be the partners that Africans and African countries choose because they have choices.
You are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Ambassador Michelle Gavin, former U.S. Ambassador to Botswana, currently Director of Africa Programs at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Susan Stigand. She's Director of Africa Programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace. We're discussing the latest developments in Africa. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. And here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Innocent Okwara from Imo State in Nigeria. And now back to our panel. Since we're talking about Russia, Michelle, let me segue right into the Russia-Africa summit taking place in St. Petersburg and the unfortunate pulling out of the Black Sea grain deal by Moscow. How is Vladimir Putin dealing with this? I understand that he is promising now tens of thousands of tons of grain from Russia to sort of mitigate the withdrawal from this deal. But I don't know that that's going to placate the African nations. There are fewer in number attending. What is your sense of the relationship now between Russia and Africa, particularly some of the countries? And where do they lay the blame for this Black Sea grain deal having been scuttled?
Well, I think it's difficult to find someone to blame besides Moscow, since they pulled out of a deal that the rest of the world was happy to see persist, and since have been deliberately attacking facilities in Ukraine that make it possible to export grain from that country. Look, I think that African states, as Susan rightly put it, have choices regarding partnerships. And there are many, many African states that are deeply concerned about being drawn into a competition in some kind of bipolar global arrangement that forces them into choices that are not in the best interest of their population. So they wish to preserve their right to pick and choose different partners. But I think also that we can see with the diminished attendance at this summit that Africans are perfectly capable of seeing when a potential partner creates a crisis and then pretends to be a great partner by offering some kind of band-aid or stopgap solution to the crisis. The nature of this exercise is not lost on any African government. So will Africans continue to engage with Russia? Absolutely, they will. And clearly, there are some governments in the Central African Republic and Mali, et cetera, that have extremely close relationships to Moscow. But I think for the vast majority, they're interested in kind of an a la carte menu of what certain partners can offer as they try and chart a course forward for their country that creates the most opportunity and responds to their urgent needs. But I don't think that there's going to be a lot of effusive praise for Moscow's offer to provide some Russian grain to ease the pain of the crisis they just created.
Clearly, the diminished attendance is a sign, Susan Stigand, that Russia is perhaps losing some influence. But how do you read the Africa-Russia summit?
Well, Carol, I think African leaders have a complex set of calculations in thinking about how to engage with Russia and how to engage with the United States and how to engage with France. In addition to this particular issue around the grain and the generous offer made by President Putin, I think what's happened in Russia over the last several weeks also feeds a sense of uncertainty about what a Russian partnership looks like. And so in the tensions and standoff that developed between President Putin and Prigozhin, I think people recognized that type of behavior and those types of dynamics because it's pretty familiar in parts of Africa, right? We just talked about that in what just happened in Niger. And I think it's left a number of countries wondering, What does a future partnership look like? It's left significant questions about the narrative that was sold by Moscow, that the Wagner Group was a separate entity. I think it's brought that quite boldly into the open. And so my sense is what we're seeing happen at the summit is not just a reflection of Russia backing out of the grain deal, but it's also a broader calculation around what is Russia's approach. What are the short-term benefits, but also the risks? I think despite the continued engagement in Central African Republic and in Mali, leaders in those countries see that there are tremendous costs in the partnership. And leadership in countries that are neighboring see those trade-offs and costs. And I think the other thing we're seeing is that, like many of us who watch African politics and watch the multilateral system, things are shifting. And it's very difficult to know how to make good decisions that are in the best interest of a country or of a national interest. And I think there's a very steep learning curve for anybody who's trying to navigate that problem set. And I think that's particularly the case for countries that have historic relationships with Russia, for countries that are facing these acute security challenges and where U.S. support comes with complicated, but we would say important conditionalities. And I think that all of those dynamics are playing out in what we're seeing in the summit this week.
Turning back to you, Michelle Gavin, let's segue now into U.S.-Africa engagement. To what extent are you optimistic about the type of relationship that the Biden administration is trying to produce? How can they capitalize, in a sense, on Russia's falling, perhaps, star, so to speak? It's being exposed for what it really is in terms of its relationship to Africa. Where do we go from here? We've seen a lot of high-level visits from the Secretary of State, from the Treasury Secretary. I don't know if you have any insight as to when Biden plans to go this year. There were structural changes on the table with regard to having Africa eventually become a member of the G20, eventually gaining a seat in the UN Security Council, and more trade. So how do you see the Biden administration and, of course, the bipartisan consensus in Congress going forward to deepen the U.S.-Africa relationship?
Well, I think broadly the right idea, but it's not enough at this stage. I think the administration has laid out a very sound strategy for moving forward, and you do see this commitment of time and attention in some areas, but there's much more to be done. It takes a lot more than high-level visits and summitry to build the kinds of partnerships that the United States is going to need in the future if we're interested in an effective multilateral system, some kind of rules-based order. There's going to have to be reform of those institutions and reforms of the rules that were created really before African equities were taken into account. High-level visits and summits do not create jobs for this growing population of young Africans who are looking for opportunity. And if you look at Afrobarometer polling, job creation is usually at the very top of the priority list. Only in places dealing with very extreme insecurity do you find security at the top. So there's much more to be done. And I think it's important for Africans to see the United States taking their priorities and their urgent crises as seriously as the U.S. takes crises in Europe, for example. So if we think about the deteriorating situation in Sudan, this horrific war that is so very costly to the Sudanese people, in addition to undermining what was a pro-democracy movement in a place that's been starved of accountable governance for such a long time, and we try and square that up with U.S. rhetoric about wanting to push back on rising authoritarianism to see resurgent democratic governance, it's not lost on Africans that you just don't see the kind of high-level attention and effective diplomacy around addressing a crisis like the war in Sudan that we're seeing in the government's full-court press on Ukraine. And those differences matter. Africans notice and they comment about them on social media every day.
Michelle Gavin, I'm so glad you combine those two topics because I did want to get into Sudan. And it's extremely important because how can you really engage in the continent when one of the largest countries has descended into civil war, a country with great promise where the people rose up and overthrew the dictator, Omar al-Bashir. So over to you, Susan Stigand at the U.S. Institute of Peace, for your take on what can be done. You can also discuss the terrible civil war in Sudan that needs to be stopped. And what role do we play, that is the United States? How can we leverage our influence with other states in the region, maybe in the Gulf Arab states? To what extent can they help restore stability? And what can we do, that is the United States, concretely to make good on this pledge to engage with Africa? What concrete steps, in addition to the summits and the great words, should we be taking to put meat on the bone, so to speak, to this strategy?
I think Michelle is exactly right, that all of the high-level visits and saying the right things and committing funds, it's an important step. It's a critical step. The message about Africa's critical role, not just in Africa, but on the global stage and wrestling with the wicked problems that face our globe and our generations, it's really important. And I don't think we should understate the importance of that commitment. But Africans and African leaders and African citizens measure that up against what the United States is doing in their own countries and in countries in the region. And I think nowhere is reconciling those realities as difficult as it is in Sudan at the moment. We're 100 plus days into horrible civil wars. I think it's a type of conflict with urban warfare that we've not really seen in Africa since fighting in Mogadishu in the 1990s, that I think has horrible echoes for U.S. interests and U.S. experience. It's spread into Darfur, where there are documented reports of violence and atrocities that may be worse than the height of the genocide in 2003. And I think even more concerning are the signals that the interests of neighboring states are at risk. And what we've seen over the last month or so is really a major increase in the number of diplomatic initiatives. The African Union continues to convene and assert leadership. The regional body, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, has named a quartet of presidents led by President Ruto. Cairo convened a meeting of neighboring states about their particular concerns. There was a consultative meeting convened in Togo, and the talks in Jeddah, co-facilitated by the United States and Saudi Arabia, while technically adjourned, the parties continue to remain in Jeddah, and it seems that some discussions are ongoing. And so on the one hand, we could see this as a signal of the degree of concern and mobilization, and I think that is true. But in many instances, I think it is on the knife's edge between wanting to be constructive in stopping the war and wanting to make sure that everybody has their finger in place to protect their own country's interests. And what I really see as missing at this point, and where I think the United States has an important role to play, is leadership on how to connect up an architecture so that all of these countries that care deeply about their borders, who care deeply about the security implications for the region overall, who care deeply about how much Gulf states are involved or not involved, who care deeply about democracy, that all of these efforts are aligned and moving in a similar direction. My sense is it will take many fora, it will take many hands, but those have to be coordinated. And we know that in a conflict in Africa, the solutions have to be African-centered, and African leadership is critical. But I think it will be insufficient because this war isn't just about Sudan. This war isn't just about Africa. This is an indication of the rivalry that's happening with middle powers, the rivalry that's happening with great powers. And so there's a real responsibility for the institutions, the regional, the African Union, the United Nations, the U.S. as a leader in the UN Security Council to define a path forward that allows space for Sudanese to come up with their own solutions. And then the other area where I think really desperately needs attention is on humanitarian assistance. More than 3 million people have been displaced by this war. There's still active fighting taking place inside of Khartoum. It is very difficult for humanitarian organizations to get access. But there is an incredible effort by Sudanese to establish what they call emergency response rooms. And these are coordinating relief. They're working at a community level. They're working with midwives unions, with doctors unions to provide response. And the U.S. and others need to be finding ways to get resources into the hands of the people who have the ability, the legitimacy, and the agility to deliver. And that's what we should be investing in the medium term for peace and democracy for this country.
Well, on that note, a very constructive one, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this final edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my terrific guests, Ambassador Michelle Gavin, former ambassador to Botswana, currently director of Africa at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Susan Stigand, director of Africa programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Thank you for listening. This is the Voice of America.